It's the Garden Nerd Tip of the Week podcast, where we spend time chatting with expert gardening guests and we ask for their favorite tip. I'm Christy Wilhelmi. Thanks for joining me. Today, my guest is Robin Jones of Honey Girl Grows. Robin designs, builds, and tends organic edible gardens and pollinator projects for resorts and corporate clients. A serious car crash was the impetus to change careers from a corporate desk job to Honey Girl Grows. Robin strives to create habitat for pollinators and butterflies through designing biodiverse ecosystems. And she collaborates with chefs and restaurants at culinary events, bringing edible flower expertise and her award-winning honeys. Thanks for chatting with me, Robin.
Hi, thanks for having me. Yay. It's so funny to hear you say this intro and have it be for me.
Yeah.
Because I've been a fangirl so long.
Oh.
And I'm used to listening to every single episode. And you have the most interesting people, and it's just funny.
Well, I'm happy to have you on here. We, as far as I can remember, we met over Instagram, and then you came up to me at the Heirloom Expo and threw your arms around me and gave me a big hug, and I was like, we're best friends! And
Well, you are a friend of Siebes Bailey.
That's right.
Who has also
yes.
been a guest on Garden Nerd.
Yes, she has.
And she's a really good friend of mine, and I do a lot of fundraising for honeylove.org. as a beekeeper, and so that's, I think, how the trifecta,
Siebes is the hub.
Yes.
Yeah, Siebes, I had Siebes on, Siebes Bailey was on the podcast a while back for chickens, because she is also a chicken keeper, and she coined the term, at least that I know of, called henopause, when hens are in it past their egg-laying age, and I have stolen that, just ruthlessly reusing that everywhere I go, and everyone laughs, and I'm like, I can't take credit for that, but it's Siebes Bailey. So
Brilliant.
She is brilliant. But I want to talk about you and the cool stuff that you're doing here. We're outside at the Red Bull corporate headquarters garden in Santa Monica, California. Can you describe for our listeners what this place looks like so that they can kind of follow along?
Sure. So everyone's surprised when they arrive at the Red Bull Garden because it's not where they expect it to be. And I'm not sure where they expected it to be. There's a big brick building, and it's surrounded by parking lot, and it's difficult to find it, but we're actually situated between KCRW on the Santa Monica City College off there, between that building and Red Bull headquarters warehouse.
Right.
So we are sandwiched between two very tall buildings. If you're at the Santa Monica City College, you have a better shot of seeing the garden
than at Red Bull.
Red Bull.
I know. It's a giant red brick warehouse, and we're basically in the strip that trucks, I guess, do have to drive by. Right? To get
well,
here
there's,
or something?
Yeah, it's a little cart that comes down here, but they do sometimes, I think, bring like some kind of giant
crane
that puts stuff on the roof and stores things.
It's, in other words, the perfect place for a garden.
Yeah.
Right? And there's a generator, which is what you hear in the background, listeners, that is probably keeping the air conditioning running inside the building. So there's this low-level ambient noise that never stops. I'm looking down, and it's all gravel and raised beds and in-ground planters with lots of stuff going on. So tell me what's growing here.
Yep. So it's a very narrow landscape, and we had these planters that were kind of like landscape planters that were already here.
Yeah.
And so we decided we should utilize them instead of fighting them. And we used them for a pollinator garden. And in between, we have narrow and beds that are built to fit those spaces that as they move along the narrow space. And they're all raised beds, cedar beds, and they're all filled with different foods and things that go to the restaurant when we harvest.
Okay. The restaurant here on campus?
Yeah, the corporate restaurant.
Oh, very cool.
So there are three buildings here. This is only one of them.
Oh.
And one of them's behind, and the other's like on the other side of Santa Monica City College.
Oh, okay.
Across the street. So we collect the compost, the food from the restaurants.
Which is so great.
So that they don't have food waste
That's
going
so
to the
fantastic.
Trash. And we bring it here and compost it. And we have a 3-bin compost system. We layer it with soil, which mm-hmm. helps speed up our progress.
Right.
We don't have any landscape, you might have noticed when you pulled into the parking lot.
Yeah.
There is literally no landscape
It's all
here.
Concrete here.
So is there are no grass trimmings, there were no leaves, there was nothing for me to collect every week to make this compost work. Mm-hmm. So I went to the warehouse and I said, I need your cardboard that you guys recycle every week. So we collect the cardboard from the recycling in the warehouse and the Amazon packages that the employees order, etc. And we wet it down, we soak it, and we try to remove all the tape and all that stuff.
The stickers.
Get it
and
as
whatnot.
Clean as we can.
Yeah.
Yeah, if we can get it without ink, we try. And then we wet it and we tear it into leaf-sized pieces so that we're imitating nature. And then we layer that. So we do our wets, then we do our browns, and we let it dry for the week. We have a bin that we keep it in to let it dry. And that part, you know, the company wasn't that thrilled about it. It's not, like, neat looking.
Oh, sure. But gardening isn't neat.
No, it's not.
Nature is not neat.
Exactly.
Nature is beautiful and closed-looped, but not neat.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But we make soil, and we made it successfully and scent-free within 6 months, which is very rare.
That is amazing.
In a three-bin system, people don't have that much success. So that's probably the thing that we grow here that I'm most proud of.
That's fantastic. And it is impressive. It's you said it was made out of recycled materials.
Yeah, the entire project was from the sustainability department. So I wanted to follow through with that mission. And it's also part of my heart and my philosophy. So I sourced old pallets and tried to make sure they weren't pressure treated or anything, you know, yucky. And,
right.
That you don't want in your food. And we hand-built the whole thing from that. It was probably way more expensive and way more labor doing it that way, I have to say.
Than new material.
Yeah.
It usually is. But it's worth it.
Yeah, it was great.
Yeah.
It's a great, and it feels right, because it's part of the mission here.
Good.
What's really cool about this space is that Pentel used to be here, the pen company.
Oh.
And they dumped so much toxic waste here that this was actually what's called a California Superfund. And a Superfund is when there's so much toxic waste that the state has to step in to actually clean it up with taxpayer money. So we are sitting in a place that used to be so toxic, there was no way you could grow plants in it. And now we have red wigglers in the soil, in the ground beds, a pollinator garden, and an edible garden, and worm bins, a compost system, and a whole, you know, system that goes all the way through.
And the employees can come out and eat lunch here, and it's really nice. It's a nice reprieve.
Yeah, we have two long tables that I help build these beds myself. Blood, sweat, and tears. So, and we have some really nice benches and tables. So
nice.
They have events here also.
Oh, very cool.
The employees.
Now, you're a beekeeper and a gardener, which is that, you know, we have this trifecta of bees and chickens and gardens, but you have the two out of three,
yes,
right?
Yes, and I grew up with chickens.
And you grew up with chickens.
In Culver City, we called it back then. Now it's very trendy and cool. When I had chickens, that was not cool, and you wouldn't have admitted it to anybody.
Oh, funny.
And my family had chickens and the whole bit. So I grew up as a kid gardening with my mom. And so it's been in me. My aunts are homesteaders. My mom's parents were farmers.
It's in your
farming
blood.
In my blood. Yeah.
Yeah, very cool. So what I see, you've got some great plants here. This is really a two-part question. So are there any plants that you always include in your gardens for pollinators? And what do you have planted here?
Okay.
There may be some overlap.
I have kind of an obsession with edible flowers. I've been studying them for years, and I'm really obsessed. I have no idea why. It's just a personal thing. So I always try to include those. And the chefs at the restaurant projects like this especially, they don't have a budget for 30 cents a piece, you know, to put a flower in a salad. So I always love including them, and they usually appreciate it greatly because they could never afford to order them or have them in their kitchen. And when I can do double duty and have edible flowers that are also edible for bees, mm-hmm. or other pollinators, that always stokes me. In fact, sometimes I do presentations on that because it's such a topic that I love so much.
Right.
So I always try to include, you know, yarrow. You can eat the leaves, mm-hmm. the root, the flowers. Bees and butterflies love them. I love viola, which is, a lot of people think of pansy, but it's the more petite
right,
version.
Right, which we have are these pansies sitting
yeah,
next
these
to
are
us?
Viola.
Viola,
yeah,
okay. Viola. Right, they're the more petite version yeah. of pansies.
So they're more like the wild viola, which we also have in this garden, actually.
Oh, very nice.
Yeah.
And I know there are all kinds of, you know, Pinterest is, I have to stay off Pinterest because it's all about sugar and chocolate and brownies and stuff. And but you can see, like, how to sugar, you know, how to preserve petals of violas and roses and that kind of stuff with sugar on Pinterest.
Yeah, I was thinking, I know Pinterest is dangerous.
It's dangerous. I can't go on there.
Brain explosion. But I was thinking of sugaring, candying Rosal hibiscus.
Ooh.
Because I'm harvesting that right now.
Oh, nice. Are you harvesting that from your own garden or one of these gardens?
My own and another for a client. I have a mini farm project at a restaurant called Five Crowns Restaurant.
Okay.
It's also called Side Door. It's two restaurants. And mm-hmm. the chefs live behind the restaurant, and they've converted their front yard in a very Newport Beach area.
Oh.
Where you would never see a farm, and it looks just like a farm.
Racy.
Yes. Very for the area.
That's very cool.
And then they have, like, a mini orchard of 13 trees and beds in the backyard also.
Very cool. Okay, I interrupted. So you were on your edible flower.
Oh, my list of flowers.
Yep.
So sunflowers are actually many fruits and not just a fruit. And those are edible, and all the petals can be used. And then, of course, you can eat the seeds. And those are such a great flower for bees. There's new research that shows that the protein from sunflowers is extra medicinal for bees.
Ooh.
And, you know, that's a flower that attracts butterflies also, and so many other pollinators. So it's really a wonder, and it's such a happy flower. And in Southern California, where we are, we can really grow them year round. Truly,
I actually just put some in the ground myself, and here we are in late October. And but they're a variety. Oh, I can't remember the name right now. I want to say it's something like Akira or something like it's from the Thomas Jefferson Monticello garden, and they said that it needs temperatures that get down to 45 degrees in order to grow well. I was like, okay, I'll plant them in fall.
Right.
So, you know, yeah, you can. We'll see yep. if it works. Anyway,
I love people don't realize that a lot of edibles are really great pollinator flora also. So I love to plant all the herbs for pollinators. And while you might want to save some for you, or you like to pinch your basil off because you want the leaves to be flavorful, I like to pinch the flowers off and put them in my pasta. They look more beautiful. All the chefs want that. When you tell people that all the chefs want that, then they're like, okay,
oh.
I want that then. and then that's beneficial for bees and butterflies. And you know, lazy gardening benefits the bees and butterflies. So whenever we can do something lazy, it's great for us as gardeners.
It's true.
It's great
so true.
For them. Mint, a borage is an absolute favorite. If you know, I have chefs who prefer the leaves of the petite leaves, the very little small,
the young leaves,
cotyledon, yeah, of the borage more than they like purslane.
Oh, really?
Yeah, microgreen almost.
You're talking about the cotyledon, so
yes,
just
literally
barely sprouted.
Yeah.
So that's for those who aren't aware, cotyledon is part of the seed. It's the very first set of seeds of leaves that show up when it sprouts, but they're not technically called leaves. They're called cotyledons. The first set of leaves are called true leaves, and they look more like what the plant will look like when it's mature.
And they're more bristly.
And they are. They're prickly. And
yeah.
I'm just trying to picture eating them.
The young ones are nice and soft.
Okay.
And sweet. And almost like a little cucumber sweetish.
Yes.
And then I love bee balm, viola, yarrow, verbena. I said that, but...
Right.
Yeah.
So like lemon verbena? Or
Lemon verbena is amazing.
Yeah.
For everything. Ice cream, making beverages or syrups or popsicles. Just the best, most summer leaf ever.
Yeah, I've made ice cream with it. What do you do for popsicles?
So whether it's popsicles or it's cocktails, you just boil like 50% sugar and 50% water mm-hmm. by weight. And I use white sugar, not organic.
Uh-huh.
And it's funny, I'm saying that almost rude because that's what we feed bees when they're starving too.
Yeah.
Which I haven't had to do this year, thank goodness, because of Super Bloom.
Yes.
It's amazing.
Right.
But then I infuse, after you heat it up, you infuse the cutting of your washed verbena leaves mm-hmm. and let it sit, and it will infuse all of that flavor. And it's almost, you want it very full of leaves. Does that make sense?
Yes.
And then you would take that and add water as needed to make your popsicles.
Oh, very cool. I want to jump ahead to your apiaries for a minute. Where are you keeping bees these days?
I'm keeping Bees that were rescued from the Malibu fires from a farm that was my growers and lost in. So they're in Brentwood at a friend who's a veterinarian, and we're looking for a home for them. I need to find a new location for those two hives. They've made it, which is cool. We call them the refugee bees. And then I keep bees in Venice Beach on a rooftop and in Laguna Beach on a hillside, and that's it right now. I have to think.
You're all over the place.
Yes.
My God.
And the hardest place for me to keep bees, and this always surprises people, is on a farm or a wild space like a green belt. Like my bees in Laguna Beach, I'm typically feeding mid-June through November on and off,
wow,
which is a lot.
That's a lot.
A lot. And it's not what I want to do. I would much rather they eat from nature.
Mm-hmm.
But if it's between them dying or not, then I have to feed them.
Yeah.
And I try to be a natural beekeeper with wild bees, and they're so hot, the temperament there, so it's not possible. I even tried doing like the next generation wild mated.
Yeah.
And they're too testy. And
we say assertive, not aggressive.
Yes.
Right? It's a thing. Although I have had bees that were absolutely aggressive. They were chasing me around the yard when I was just trying to garden. I'm like, that is not assertive.
Yeah, so
it's aggressive.
High percentages of Africanized DNA can take all the joy out of beekeeping.
Totally.
They're murderous.
They are.
Awful.
Yeah. So you do buy queens? Is that what you're...
So I purchase queens.
Yeah.
Yeah, typically from Oliveira's Bees. There's a San Diego breeder, but their queens are too hot. So it's the problem with Southern California. Northern California doesn't have the Africanized DNA influence. We do because we're warmer. So I can't, you know, I just have found the only breeder down here, their bees are too hot. It's like one out of three.
Everyone's always so surprised at how spicy our bees are down here. Because they're up north, they're like, oh yeah, we don't wear protection while checking our hives. I'm like, screw you.
Well, come down here.
It's not a loss for me, believe me.
Well, it really depends. So
yeah.
I have to, yeah, it's, okay, so it's, I had this struggle because I really wanted to do wild DNA.
Yeah.
But I can't because I'm in areas with kids, dogs, horses, and also very, very close neighbors.
Yeah.
And so when the painter across the street, 3,000 feet away, is, or, you know,
getting stung.
Farther getting stung, then that,
that's an,
you know,
issue.
It's your responsibility. So I use the more docile DNA of the commercial bred bees from Oliveira's Bees, and I've been happy with their DNA. It's been good for me. And the problem with that DNA is that the more docile the DNA, the more babying they take.
Right.
And if you're in, so it's funny, I have that same DNA in Brentwood, and they have food stores almost year-round.
Huh.
No feeding necessary. And urban areas, you know, just do better because they're on automatic water, so they have things blooming almost year-round.
Right.
In urban areas. But when we go rural on a green belt, they starve. So
because of the seasonality.
Yes.
Yeah, exactly.
So I have to baby them a lot more in wild, on green belts or wild spaces.
Yeah. Do you have any pointers about rooftop beekeeping for those who are interested in trying it themselves?
I love rooftop beekeeping. Most people cringe at those two words because you're hauling things up and down off the roof.
That's what I think about.
Yeah. So
and how heavy it is.
I have no idea why, but I'm a freak for everything rooftop gardens and bees. Because it's an unused space.
Mm-hmm.
It can actually add lead points to a building. So for corporate projects, I'm always trying to help tell them your rent can actually go up and the value of your property. It can lower your heat and your energy bills. It's just, it's like growing vertically. You're offering a space that wasn't used.
Right.
For something that's going to add nature.
Now, I have a question specifically, and this is why I asked if you had any pointers, because most of the rooftops in Southern California, at least on corporate buildings, are not built to handle snow or heavy weight. So what do you do to disperse the weight of beehives, or how do you manage that?
So if you don't have a space, or you haven't planned it and you're going to build something, make sure that you build it with all of your safety concerns in mind, and a pulley system is smart to lower things or bring up equipment.
That's genius.
Yeah. I never light my smoker until I'm on the roof. Never, ever light it below.
Yeah.
You will.
That's a really bad idea.
Yeah, it's just too much risk involved. Have a can, like, you know, a Barron's manufacturing stainless steel, galvanized steel can, like a trash bin, but bigger.
With a lid
for your smoker for fire safety. Have a another one that holds your fire extinguisher, or have it mounted. Then with the pulley system, I try not to take the boxes up and down a whole lot. I try to use a smaller, it's called a nucleus.
Yes.
And there are to-go versions
right.
of those that are disposable that I don't ever dispose of. So those are very light. They're cardboard.
I have one of those as
yes.
a swarm box for rescuing
exactly.
colonies.
And
yeah.
That is very handy in moving frames of bees up and down the ladder.
That's so
it's
smart.
Way less weight and you're way less likely to have some drama occur.
Right. Or drop them on the way down.
Exactly.
Or
and you don't want any drama in beekeeping.
Drama with beekeeping is a terrible idea.
Exactly.
Right.
It's not fun.
Yeah. Those are genius ideas that I would never have thought of on my own. Thank you very much. I love that you think outside the box. And I think that's really what all of Honey Girl Grows is about, is thinking outside the box. You do science-based beekeeping and these gardens that are for pollinators, and you're thinking outside the box in terms of how to use them in experiences for people. So that's just,
yes,
it's all great.
My original goal was to create pollinator programs with corporate and resorts so that both the community and the guests at the resorts could get education from it. And it's funny that you bring up the science thing, because the reason I was such a fangirl for you initially was you were the first and only science-based gardener that I had ever see speak or
yeah.
bring in science and talk about the science of gardening. And that's my nerd stuff. Like, I just get very excited
checks
over
all
that
the boxes.
Stuff. It's really funny.
Yes.
Because I never thought of myself as a sciencey person. I thought of myself as a creative.
Yeah,
coming
same
from
here.
Advertising and being very right-brained, and so it was funny.
Cool. Well, we are totally in sync here, so that's awesome.
So I have to say, all the things that I struggle with beekeeping, becoming a beekeeper and learning and the whole process, the hardest thing for me was to decide what kind of beekeeper to be.
Oh.
And so calling myself, I say I try to be a science-based beekeeper. It's very difficult to try to be a science-based beekeeper, especially now because more and more people have more awareness of scientific studies.
Yeah.
And so they're trying to do things that are aligning with those or backed by them.
And, Michael Bush is really good on the science from what I've seen him speak. Are you familiar with his
stuff? I am. I actually had a friend who is backfilling his books, like trying to go backwards to add the science in.
Oh.
In reverse.
Uh-huh.
Like trying to find studies that will ladder up to things he's claimed that he wrote in the books
years
ago.
Interesting. Okay. Because
yeah.
I saw him speak at there was a Honeylove symposium in 2000.
Yes.
When was that?
There's going to be another one in January.
Yes, in January 2020.
Coming in January.
Coming to the...
Yes, yeah, finally.
Very excited about that.
Yeah.
But Michael Bush spoke about how the native bees, or the feral, or what we're calling now
wild
bees, good protocol, they resist phroamites in a different way. You know, they don't have to be as coddled as the packages that you buy, because they tend to. However, okay,
there is a commercial beekeeper who is a science-based beekeeper, and he's the only researcher who is a commercial has a commercial operation. He doesn't even run it anymore. His sons do.
Okay.
It's Randy Oliver of scientificbeekeeping.com. He is the first in the world. The world is watching him, and the only to raise 250 mite-free commercialized colonies.
Wow.
They are treatment-free. He's the ultimate treatment-free beekeeper. They are treatment-free, and they are 100% mite-free. So he's raising for DNA.
Very cool. That's
so
exciting.
That's about to change. Very exciting.
Wow.
The other breeders said it wasn't possible, he's not interested in becoming a breeder, but they said it wasn't possible and it would be too expensive.
So he needed to prove them wrong.
So he went to prove them wrong. And it benefited his operation because he hasn't spent time treating, right?
Right.
So
it's great.
Yeah.
Okay. My next question, it's total pivot. You have quite a following on Instagram, and I think it's because you use it like a blog and you give great tips. One of the things I wanted to ask you is about, you mentioned something the other day about pruning timing for milkweed, for tropical milkweed in particular, here in Southern California, because we're dealing with the pathogen that I'm going to try and say this. It's OE for short, but it's Ophryocystis electroshira? Is that how you say it?
Don't ask me.
Okay.
I'm amazed that you even attempted.
Ophryocystis electroshira. I'm going to go with that. It's OE, and it's a pathogen that attacks the milkweed, and then it basically kills the monarch butterfly larva, the caterpillars that are on the milkweed.
Yeah, it's a parasite, so it parasites the butterflies, and
right.
When they land on the plant, it's transferred.
Oh, is that how it happens?
Yeah.
I thought that the milkweed picks it up, but
it's transferred to the milkweed, yes.
It is, okay.
And then if the egg is laid near it, we have a specific protocol to try to kill it. And then we test before release to make sure we're not releasing butterflies because they raised over 100 monarch butterflies in a project with a pollinator garden just a few miles from here and an edible garden. So I built a specific, you're going to have to say this word, Leopardotum. Basically, it's a butterfly nursery.
Oh, cool.
And I built one that's custom made. It's my design. I had it a prototype in December and we launched by spring. And so it's a project that I'd like to take to resorts also so that they can do this butterfly egg hunting with kids.
With kids. Oh, perfect.
Exactly. And their executive team was trained by me, and then they trained team butterflies at their corporate. So they are raising butterflies there. I also am putting in plants that, help support things like El Segundo Blues and other butterflies that are threatened in L.A. for extinction. But with the monarch, to come back to the OE.
Yes.
They lay on the plant, the egg, and if they are infected with that parasite, then they can transfer it onto the plant, and those cells can transfer onto the caterpillars when they birth out or to the egg when it's laid. There is a protocol that you wash the leaf in 98% water, 2% bleach. Remember that household bleach is only 5% anyway, and that bleach is a natural substance, so people get a little freaked out by that. You do want to wash it off with all water after.
Uh-huh.
And then that helps reduce that recycling or repeating. The other concern is not just OE, but there's a bacterial infection that monarchs can get. And we don't know enough, quite honestly, to know what it is when it presents. The OE shows up on a microscope as a specific cell pattern, so you can tell whether a butterfly has it or not.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
And so if you take something, is there a physical manifestation that you can see with the eye?
No, you can't. And so occasionally you will get, and sometimes it's as high as 50% of your what you're raising, so 50% of your caterpillars or 50% of your butterflies will get and it could, we don't know if it's bacterial or if it's OE. There's no way to tell until they're butterflies.
Mm-hmm.
Occasionally they'll get this kind of dark and dusty look.
Yeah.
And then they'll die.
I've seen that.
And I don't want people to go killing their caterpillars because they see it.
Right.
You know, it's part of nature. It's part of what we have. And there's not much we can do. So we do try to raise them in separate habitats so that they're not infecting each other.
And so we have been instructed that if you do have tropical milkweed, that it's really important to cut it down because it doesn't die over winter. Your post on Instagram suggested a different timing than I'm used to hearing.
Yes. So I follow the National Wildlife Federation, and they recommended December 25th. We don't have winter, so tropical milkweed doesn't die on its own. So you would cut 3 to 4 inches from the soil height. You would cut your plants, and you're going to be afraid, really? I'm going to give it this kind of a hack, but it'll come back just fine with gusto in the spring. We are cutting it to reduce the number of pathogens that are, or parasites that are recycling through the season or perpetuating. And then there's a lot of chatter about milkweed being bad and which milkweed is good. The fact of the matter is that I studied this, and I'm not an expert in this. I'm not an entomologist, but there are a few experts in this, and I forget who it was. It's in one of my posts, but he said, look, we have no evidence that the milkweed is the cause of monarchs not migrating. It is more likely that it's global warming, but so there is no bad milkweed. We've had tropical milkweed in Southern California for over 100 years, and it hasn't been a problem. That it's now, in the last however many years, 20 years, 10 years, become a problem, indicates that it's not a concern.
It's not the milkweed, it's the other
it's
stuff.
Something else, yeah.
Interesting.
But the pathogens and the parasites are a problem.
They are a problem.
Yeah.
And so, because I see from other institutions where they suggest cutting it down in the fall, not in full winter, but in the fall. And I did. I took mine down because I planted seeds for native milkweed, but what came up does not, it really looks like tropical milkweed. So I'm playing it safe and I'm cutting it back. So I've already done that. But then I read your post and I thought, oh, shoot. I should have waited.
Well, you just get a little spurt, so...
They're coming. It's coming back already.
Yeah, we have taconid fly. Taconid fly.
Is that how you say it? Because I've always said taconid.
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 Like Hawaiians would say.
Oh.
Taconid. My entomologist friend had to teach me.
Okay.
Randy. So taconid fly is high in high heat seasons. So August, they really hit stride. They show up in the Red Bull Garden here in July. Early July, and then they kind of just pretty much knock out 90% of every monarch butterfly all the way through September, and we're in October right now, and we're having 84 degrees, 86 degrees, our Indian summer that we have every year, and every year we think it's such a surprise.
It's the false fall.
Yes. So that fly will wipe them out, because we're getting cooler in the evenings, their numbers will decline, and then they'll hit stride again, and then they'll be finished for the year. You may have one, you know, lonely cocoon in February, and they may or may not overwinter. It depends.
Got it. Well, on that note, that's so depressing. But it's tip time. Do you have a favorite tip that you'd like to share with the garden nerd audience?
I have several.
Okay.
I wrote down for you.
Fire away.
How many do you want?
Let's start with your first favorite tip.
Do you want bees or gardening?
Let's do gardening.
Okay.
Because we've been talking about bees and butterflies for a while.
So, really quick list of tips. Don't put rocks in the bottom of your containers.
Right. That's
you
old school thinking.
You create a water table.
Yeah.
It's still such a bad rumor that's going around, so don't do that. And then you want a different soil for those containers. You want a lighter soil. So you want a soil that's four pots, so go seek that out. Hopefully something organic. And if you don't know how to find that or have difficulty finding it, you could just buy a bag of perlite from Home Depot and mix it in to lighten up your, like a 4-to-1 mix.
Okay.
One cup of perlite for 4 cups of soil. What else? Drip irrigation is a life changer. Remember college when you didn't have like a washer dryer or maybe you didn't have a dishwasher? And how much quality of life you lost.
Yeah.
Like how much time you spent washing dishes or going to the laundromat. Drip irrigation is exactly like that. If you've been functioning as a gardener without it, go put it in.
Make the investment and it will change your life and your water bill.
Your garden succeeds without you.
Yeah. It's pretty
despite
much.
Despite you.
Yeah. Certainly over winter, it is like the garden grows itself here. It's hands off practically.
Yes.
You just come out and harvest. It's the best growing season, by the way, listeners, dear listeners. Fall is the best growing season. I will say it again every single time.
That was my next tip.
Oh, really?
Yeah. It's full spring in Southern California.
Yeah.
And no one knows it, but if you track the weather and the temperatures every year, it mimics spring exactly.
Yeah.
So I plant for spring in fall.
Yes.
And everyone can. And if you're not, you're missing out.
Totally. All your brassicas do better in the fall.
Yep.
Because the Bagrata bug breeds in temperatures over 73 degrees, which is in spring. Not now. Well, not after the heat wave passes, but that's how it works. Yeah.
Yep.
Any last tips before I close out?
Powdery mildew.
Powdery mildew.
It's the bane of most Southern California gardeners, especially coastal like we are.
Yes.
And you've given me so much good learning that I have to share your listeners and you this tip because it's life-changing.
Okay.
It's called Lost Coast Therapy.
Lost Coast Therapy.
Plant. Lost Coast Plant Therapy.
Plant Therapy.
Lost Coast Plant Therapy. Wipes out powdery mildew. You only have to spray like every 3 weeks at the most. Sometimes you can go longer.
And what is it?
It's peppermint oil based and totally organic. I learned about it from a dahlia farmer who learned about it from an organic pot farmer. It's mind-blowing how well it works. It's my best kept secret.
I'm going to try this.
You can grow tomatoes at the beach, people.
Wow.
Yeah, it'll change your life.
Okay, that is huge. I'm going to look this up, and we will post a link to this on the blog post after this. Wow, Robin, thank you so much for all of these great tips and for being a guest on the Garden Nerd Tip of the Week podcast.
Thank you so much for having me.
How do people find you?
My website is honeygirlgrows, G-R-O-W-S, like G like George. People always think it's .com. People always think it's honeygirlrose, what?
No.
And then it's honeygirlgrows at Instagram and Facebook as well.
All right, Garden Nerds, you'll find links to Robin's Instagram feed on gardennerd.com this week. We'll also point to her Facebook page and her story on the Urban Permaculture website. As well as, of course, all of her social media whatnots. That's it for this week. Subscribe to this podcast on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen. Visit us for tons of free gardening information at gardennerd.com. Show your support for this podcast and the other free stuff on Garden Nerd by becoming a Patreon subscriber. You'll find us on Instagram and Twitter under GardenNerd1, on Facebook as gardennerd.com, and, of course, our Garden Nerd YouTube channel. Happy gardening!